Welcome to In Pursuit of Luxury Live, Season 10 of the In Pursuit of Luxury podcast. Continuing our focus on the amazing live discussions we had at the In Pursuit of Luxury Conference 2025, Honest Luxury, this time we are bringing you part two of an amazing conversation between Dame Zandra Rhodes, Maria Grushvogel, Richard McVettis, and Piers Atkinson.
Right, it's enough of me, I think. Are there any questions? Does anybody want to ask our amazing paneling questions? And I think you might, is there a microphone? I think there's a microphone. Does anybody have a question? Otherwise we can just, we can probably talk for hours, but if anyone has a question, feel free.
We don't bite.
We don't bite.
I have a question. I've been in the fashion industry for a long time. I know some of the panel. I totally understand in terms of having to think about education and helping younger people to understand the creativity, the cost, the implication. But I also appreciate, because I do some visiting lecturing myself, that the brain of young people has changed. Speed, the attention span, engagement, everything comes from the phone. So, reading, researching, understanding is incredibly challenging. And I'm sure as lecturers, anybody who teaches will know that. I myself have had to change the way that I lecture because of attention span. So how do you, all of these very, very specialized designers, how do you think that you can change or compete with that mindset to kind of rebalance the speed and the overconsumption? Sorry, that's a very long question. Apologies.
Who would you like to answer that?
Anybody who feels the need.
You two are very eloquent.
Oh, gosh. I'm not sure if I have the answer because I have the same trouble, maintaining sort of people's attention. I think it's really hard. I've also had to adjust the way I do sort of lectures, like, or symposiums that last more than 2 hours without a break every 15 minutes to reframe. So I think, we are in a slight problem with this idea of attention. But I suppose, I actually find that's a really difficult question, and I'm not really sure if I have the answer. I mean, I'm lucky that I have got something that I feel like I have a purpose, that I have something to occupy my time with. So I feel very fortunate that I can detach from that sort of way of thinking, that I can detach myself from a digital.
How did you discover that you loved embroidery and using your hands and a needle and thread in that way?
Embroidery was a bit of a chance encounter, so I don't think I necessarily would put myself in that, because as you would imagine, it takes a long time. I would say it's the most uncommercial part of my practice, I would say. So I'm I do lots of other things to maintain a sort of life here in London. But I think I've always been encouraged to play and to make. And I suppose I'm pre-email, pre-technology. And so my mom and dad were very less hands-off with me, and I was just told to go and play. So I've always had that ability to be a self-starter and to be able to do what I want. And I've always found ways of occupying myself. And I think quite often nowadays we always want to be entertained. We always want our time to be filled, and we don't just sit and be. And I think without those moments of sitting and being, which is the attention deficit thing that we have, right? Because everyone is mining us for that attention. And I'm afraid these multi-million tech companies have spent a long time designing this, and it's even I find it really hard to resist that. I think so.
It's very addictive.
Yeah.
It's very addictive. And I have a 15-year-old, and actually what's quite interesting from what you said, and, I'm very aware of, let's say, the problem with digital, and we also brought him up in a way to sort of let him play. And last year he said to me, I've really got to get off my phone. He said, it's just too addictive. I've got to get off my phone because I need to focus on my GCSEs. I need to focus on revision. And so I said, well, you need to figure out a way to do that. And he said something that I thought was really interesting. He said, and this is a 15-year-old boy. He said, when I sit and play with my Lego, I can just let my mind go. And so I said, well, then maybe you should play Lego more and take your phone less. And, you know, he started to do things like that, and he'll play a bit on the piano or, you know, do some other, let's say, more creative things. And I think over time, it's already being a conversation now, the digital conversation. Over time, more and more young people will take themselves off and start to reclaim their time.
Can I say that I'm not against digital either, because I think there's lots of really amazing digital craft out there and digital making, and actually it's a really relevant and vital skill to the world. And it's still, and I think if you can engross yourself and be creative through digital means, that's very different to what is happening within social media and all these other companies, right? So I think, you know, Minecraft and all these games, I think they are really creative. And I think they're just as vital to creativity as well and play.
I think we're all talking about using our hands again. So the importance of using our hands and not waiting to be entertained by the machine, as it were. So I teach here at Ravensbourne, and I constantly really worry about young people's ability to concentrate or dare to play or to take risks, because so much they see is finished and polished. And so they're not in a classroom full of people playing, as it were, and seeing the successes and the failures. But all of us have actually learned what we've done by our successes and failures, by that seam that you didn't use the right cotton the first time or whatever it is. So I think playing and learning is something that I would love to see young people in schools being encouraged to do more. But our educational system, I mean, we're talking about some really big problems here in my, we're talking about aggressive capitalism, we're talking about the education system, we're talking about the cost of living and time, the gap between the rich and the poor, and we're covering some really heavy, I'm sitting here having really a bit of an existential crisis, actually, a lot of the things that people are saying. But in our small way that we can do here in the audience or on the panel in our own practice, is to encourage each other and especially young people to use their hands and play with Lego and get off the screen and I don't know and pressing flowers or all the things that you might do that gives you so much joy and that you remember. Who can remember the last thing you saw on Instagram? No one can remember the last thing you looked at. But you do remember pressing flowers with your grandma. My mum had a really interesting observation. She knew the world was changing when it was cheaper to buy a knitted jumper than to buy the wool and knit the jumper. She said that was the moment she thought she knew the world had changed. And I guess that was in the late 70s and the beginning of aggressive capitalism. So I thought that was quite a nice quote, yeah.
Oh, interesting. Any other questions? Tim, should I? Sorry, you inadvertently became the mic carrier.
That's it. Susan Muncy. I wanted to ask you about dishonest luxury and the fact that there are so many fakes and copies around at the moment. I think it's something that has been facilitated by the digital realm, by artificial intelligence and the ability to 3D print things, to replicate things online through imagery. And I wonder if any of you have had any difficulties with people copying your designs or ideas. I mean, I think plagiarism is rife within the fashion industry. It's a case of everybody being inspired by everybody else. But I think that in the luxury world, people are beginning to wonder, you know, what is authentic and what is authenticity today?
I think the ownership of a design idea is quite a Western concept, actually. So I've had my stuff copied, you know, enormously. I don't know who that is. I think you're a static centre of attention. Or is it those colourful trousers? I don't know. So the idea, the ownership of an idea or a kind of an IP seems to be quite Western in a way. But yeah, I mean, all of us have been copied, I'm sure. I mean, one of my first hats were two pom-poms on a beanie, my first collection. And I think you see that's made everywhere. I don't know whether I invented it, but that was my first thing. And then suddenly I've seen that go all around the world. We've just looked at an advert where direct elements are taken from your designs.
We keep a book, and it's labelled knockoffs. And we photographed, because once, years ago now, I was phoned up and everyone was congratulating me on being on the front cover of, one of those free magazines. And it wasn't mine, it was Miu Miu. I couldn't do anything about it. So I now just keep the pictures and label them, because there's
nothing you can do.
And then you have to say, well, maybe it was a compliment that they had to copy that exactly. So, I think UK is a very original nation, though, and we have to concentrate on our originality, that everyone has to knock us off, as it were.
Yeah. Knock us off. But does anybody care? I mean, that's the thing. Does anyone really care about, I don't know, a fake Louis Vuitton bag? I mean, it's all made so unsustainably anyway. We shouldn't be buying any of it.
Well, wasn't that the brilliant joke in the trade war, or not joke, but in the trade war, were these wonderful posts coming from the Chinese manufacturers who were saying, well, we make your Hermes bags, but we can make them for you. If we're going to do that, just come straight to us and we'll do it for a tenth of the price. And I just thought that was a wonderful, I mean, we all know that. If we work in the industry, but that really went across social media, and I think that opened a lot of people's eyes. Yeah, that was quite interesting.
I mean, and it goes back to the dishonest honesty, I think, because we are sold such a lot of nonsense from all of the brands that are selling us luxury. So when you were talking about luxury, I was thinking to myself, is that even luxury? You know, the things you're talking about, you know, whether it's Louis Vuitton or me, you know, name shaming, but all of that has always for me been questionable.
I used to work in fashion retail for a very long time, so I do have experience of certain brands who would get their stuff made in other countries and then they ship it back to the country of origin where the brand exists and then go made in Germany, made in Britain. So I think that's also dishonest.
So, but it comes back to Britain, and just sew in your made in Britain label, exactly. And there it is.
The final construction. Okay. The final construction is in the corridor.
Full detail.
Yeah, they might lace the shoe or something like that, and then it becomes made in Germany. Yeah.
Anything? Any other questions, Margaret? Yeah, and then you go next. Yeah.
Hello, Margaret MacLeod from Harris Tweed Hebrides. So, thank you, everyone. That's been a really interesting discussion. One of the challenges we have, certainly, is that our world is becoming more about compliance rather than beautiful fabrics. So you present your fabrics, but then we fall on compliance because this world of sustainability and compliance doesn't always agree with small batch production, with fibre that's grown on sheep farms across the UK. You know, these brands and customers are kind of moving towards a big hurdle of compliance, which Europe's going towards as well. Any comments?
I think people haven't really considered the implication on a small business of all that compliance. I had a chat with, in fact, I was interviewed by the British Fashion Council exactly about that. And they're very much of the opinion, oh, yes, it's all, you know, going to be great for brands like you. And you're like, well, actually, it puts a huge amount more red tape. I have no clue what I'm doing. There's nobody in my company that does this job, so guess who has to do it on top of my day job, to try and find out all of the things that we, number one, need to do and then put a plan in to execute it in a business with a tiny number of staff and no specific person to do that. That actually puts quite a large burden. So that's my personal feeling. It's not that I don't want to do it and become more sustainable, but it's a hurdle in a small company.
Anyone else?
Nothing to add. I mean, absolutely the same, 100%.
Hi. Thank you for the talk. I have a question on the educating customers. So I remember you and think you have mentioned about educating consumers. Do you believe that brands should start educating their customers from the first touch point? Or I don't know if you could elaborate on that a little bit for educating.
You mean from the point of origin?
Yeah.
I think it would be really interesting to... But Sandra and I were actually having a conversation this weekend about silk chiffon, and there are ways now to make silk without boiling the little silkworms. So you could sustainable, like nicely remove their cocoons instead of lethally remove their cocoons. So I actually think it would be really interesting to see the story from... I don't even know the silkworm farmers, and is it mulberry leaves or I don't know what they eat, but I've seen some things on YouTube of how those farmers work, and see the story of the silk, the weaving, the printing and the cutting and the making, and even the event where that gown might end up. That would make a lovely film. I don't know how we couldn't afford to fund a film of that it would cost too much for a designer to fund, but wouldn't that be a lovely film for us all to watch of everything that we consume as shoppers?
That strikes me, though, as education for schools more than anything else, don't you think?
I think almost all the things we're talking about go back to education and, explaining, talking about it. As we are.
I agree. And I think the more that we do it and the more, because the younger generation have really lost touch with how to make things. So I had my son make a pair of trousers when he was about 10 or 11. I was like, oh, would you like a pair of trousers? And he was, oh, yes, because of course he's very excited about it. And I said, well, but you can make it. We can make it. We can go to my studio and I can show you how to do that. And of course, he was very excited. But he did spend... most of the time, how long, because he didn't realise it takes actually a long time, but it was such a good lesson for him to do that. I cut it, his hands were too little at the time to cut the trousers, but I made sure he sewed every single stitch himself so that he learned how to put something together and wear it. And I designed them in such a way that he could still wear them now as more like a kind of crop length. He still loves them. He still brings them out and wears them because he made them himself and he feels very proud of that.
My mum got me to pattern cut, I suppose, cut out from fabric, but we did it on paper first because she knew I was going to go in and cut right out the middle, you know, like kids always do. So I remember that. Reminded me of moving the pattern pieces around. And so you can use as much fabric as you, well, this is relevant to Harris Tweed as well, use the fabric in the right way. It was unpatterned, so I didn't have to make things match up. But that was a wonderful lesson to learn, and I remember it now, yeah.
But what you said is so incredible, and how little it doesn't happen enough with people now. I would have thought from listening to things on the radio, I don't have any children, but the fact that they don't always have parents that will teach them something like that, though, therefore they're getting everything from a phone and they're not learning the reality of what it's like to make a pair of trousers or even wash things, you know, they're not learning in the same way that we would have done when we were young. And that is a real problem.
Yeah. I want to go back to the two points, the one Margaret made about regulation and the one you made about origin. Do people care? Does the consumer care? So at the space that you guys are in, do the people that come to you care about any of that, about regulation, which is inherent in the production cycle, and all the origin, which are related because they, you know, there's connectivity between both those ideas? Does the customer care?
Some do, some don't. And it's growing. You know, people are more aware of it now. And some do, some don't, is what I would say. But I think in the main, it hasn't reached the full public awareness yet, but it will, because if this becomes the new normal, then it will, and we will have to do it, and it will have to be part of our job, and I am doing it and working through all of that stuff in the same way as it took me 2 years to get my head around Brexit and what all of that paperwork meant, you know, because again, there's nobody in my company doing that except me. So, yeah, it cost me a lot of money.
But Richard, do people care where your thread comes from, for example, with your embroidery thread?
No one asked me that. No one's ever asked me where my thread comes from or my fabric. I suppose it's not really something I really sort of talk about. I mean, they're interested in the story, right? The story is part of everything, right? And that's where a lot of the value comes from, I think. So I think the more you try and express that story in the way that it's made and manufactured and the story behind it, then that's really important. But, being sustainable is not the thing that is at the forefront of my practice. I would say I make really slow work. So therefore, I am sustainable in the very fact that I don't make a lot of stuff. And I also teach a lot. I teach at university, but I also teach people how to sew and how to make. And I've been doing that longer than being a university tutor. So for 14, 15 years, teaching people how to hold a material in their hand, how to thread a needle, and actually inviting them for that moment of time just to sit and make. And I think that for me is a really beautiful aspect of what I do, you know, other than just making artwork, which is very expensive, but that sort of teaching people how to make, how to sew things, how to thread a needle, how to tie a knot. It's amazing how many people don't know how to do any of these things. And I would like to say about the sort of standardization, I think, again, you're right, not many people really are interested in. I mean, I'm interested because I'm in that area. So I will look at the label on a piece of clothing, see where it's been made, and maybe do a bit more research on a brand's website. I'll go to Toast and they'll have a whole story about sustainability. But I think a lot of companies might just ignore that unless we make it compulsory. And so there is a balance between legislation and also, because if we just let people do what they want, most likely people want deregulation, right? Because that's what the world is wanting right now. Deregulation, because it makes it easier for them to exploit and make money out of other people. So actually there's a balance there that has to be struck somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think next year, the part of the Institute of Luxury conference is Zandra's doing a workshop around print design. Piers is doing a millinery course. You're doing some pattern cutting and Richard's doing embroidery. Perfect.
Done.
Okay. Yeah, that was easy. Any other questions? In the front and then in the back. Can you shout?
So fast fashion is radically different from what anyone in this room works in. But it seems increasingly difficult for consumers to find anything but fast fashion on one end and then what's sold as luxury on the other end. How have you found that fast fashion has influenced any of you all in terms of your business, in terms of your creativity, and in terms of the way that customers and consumers relate to fashion items and think about pricing and think about how they consume these items?
I would consciously distance myself from fast fashion. So I've been approached by quite a big high street global fashion brand to do one of those collaborations, and I just didn't want to do it. I didn't want versions of what I do to be everywhere. I felt that would devalue, literally and metaphorically, devalue what I do. And I think I'm a bit more like you, Richard. My practice is quite slow and considered rather than necessarily eco, although I do choose to use byproducts rather than in terms of animal products. So I use byproducts. So the leather I use is a byproduct from the meat industry, and the same with feathers, actually. I would consciously distance myself from a fast fashion brand for sure. I think I read somewhere that there's enough clothing to clothe the next six generations of humankind on the planet already. I mean, that's crazy. So, yes, no to fast fashion from me.
What about you, Zandra? Fast fashion influencing you?
I'm not really involved in anything like that now, as I'm only really restoring all the stuff that I did. But my stuff was very hand-to-mouth, you know. It's more like big name and small products. So I'd be making, you know, small amounts of things when I was making.
I think with fast fashion, I think it's really about the speed of it. And you're right that having, you know, I certainly noticed with Zara, when that first came around, consumers were really going into Zara and buying all of the kind of latest looks, which were essentially knockoffs for the designer products. And I think what was interesting is that the luxury fashion industry responded not by differentiating themselves from that, but by speeding up also. And I chose a different path from that, actually. And I've noticed that, you know, of course you're going to have those people that are going to shop at Zara. And my customer would have been the customer that would have done probably a bit of that and a bit of mine. But increasingly what I'm seeing and what I'm very hopeful for is that you start to see that people realize, in fact, somebody said to me, actually, I realize you're my very cheap wardrobe because I don't throw anything away of yours. Nothing of yours retires. And I've now got a section in my wardrobe that's just of yours. And they're buying less and less of the fast fashion as a result. So it's a small whisper of, you know, I suppose change, as it were. But I do see the hope in that people are starting to realise that it's a bit of a false economy to buy something at a cheap price, wear it five or six times and it falls apart because it's not built to last.
I saw a beaded, this is a few years ago, I saw an advert for a beaded dress, summer dress, sequined summer dress, and it was £9.99. And I found that so shocking. I just thought, I wouldn't even cut it out for £9.99, you know? You know what I mean? Let alone sew it.
Would you wear it for £9.99?
Do the fabric. Yeah, so I'm being a bit of a diva. I won't get out of bed for less than £9.99.
there's a question at the back.
I think fast fashion has affected the way people perceive my work as well, because they really, again, they don't have an understanding of how things are constructed or made, because you might get something heavily embroidered in India or China where living is less and people don't require as much money. So when they see my work and they understand, and I don't even charge the labour, right? Because it would be astronomical, the amount of time that I spend on it. So there's this sort of disconnect between, because textiles is everywhere and therefore it's ubiquitous and it's, you know, it's in every shop, it's all over, it's on the streets, you know, you see it hanging on lampposts and on the floor. I think the way we value textiles is really low, and that's because it's because it's everywhere, right? And so we're invisible, we're blind to the fact of how it's produced and the complexity of production and the value of the material that we're making. So when people see my work and they come to my studio, they're like, for that, you know, it's like a tiny circle that I've embroidered and I've spent 3 weeks doing it. They find that really hard to equate in terms of money and time, and also the value of people's time, right? We value people's time less. I mean, it started for embroidery, medieval England, right? 12th to 14th century, England was the centre of the embroidery trade, and then slowly it's been moving east via London, then it went to the Netherlands, and then it progressed to east, and now we have it mainly a lot of embroidery, India and China. So this sort of sense of value, I think we've completely lost in understanding how that is made. Yeah, textiles, specifically embroidery, again, was a sign of power because you could afford the labour, right, to house you, to have the most lavish garments, to then have paintings of these beautiful embroideries, you know, Holbein paintings with the beautiful embroidery on. So this sense that embroidery has really lost that idea of what value means and whose labour, I think.
Great. At the back.
Thank you for your thought-provoking discussion. It's been a fantastic opportunity for me to reflect on a couple of points. As a context, I'd like to give you my question. The first is about the discussion on educating the consumers. In this context of democratization of luxury that we're looking around us, even the institutions that represent the so-called luxury these days, such as Walpole, Institut Colbert, Alta Gamma, for example, are representing what I personally think is not really luxury. And then we see a world of co-creation as well, where it becomes very hard for the luxury brands or the so-called luxury brands to control the narrative. And an example of this is Bottega Veneta, they no longer have Instagram, for example, because it doesn't really represent them. So this is the context that I've been reflecting on as I've been listening to your discussion. So my question is, I see this term of meta-luxury as a perfect example of what the real maker and the connoisseur should be like. And I think that market is still there. So the question based on this is, do you think there is a new market being born in this case, and that the focus shouldn't be about educating people, but about thinking on how to grow or see this new meta-luxury market being born, which is basically the maker versus communicating to the connoisseur rather than the producer, mass producer, to the consumer? And if so, to what extent should you control this narrative?
Good and long question. Who wants to answer that one? Who's?
Dear. Yes, I think there is. I think there is a new customer, I think we are. And I hate to say it. I think it's because of things like Instagram. So I think there are ways that we can reach as smaller companies or smaller creatives, independent creatives. I think we can reach a global audience through the internet and through social media, and you know, people buy my things from all around the world. I was quite interested you using the word connoisseur, because a connoisseur is an educated buyer, I suppose. So I liked hearing that word, because we're talking about educating, we're talking about explaining our processes, and we're talking about our clients actually enjoying having and sharing that knowledge. So a connoisseur, I'm going to use that word, I think, a bit more, connoisseur. So we can be craftspeople and designers and makers. We need to link up with the connoisseurs, I think. And that can be at any price point, I think, really. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think I've seen that there's a growing... there's a growing awareness of all of this mass production and all of this consumption. And actually, I think by what's happened is the quality has really dropped over the last, I don't even know how many years. But I think this sort of slow shift is happening, and it's creating a customer that's saying, actually, I don't need to follow trends anymore. I can follow my own style. These are the bits that I wear. These are the bits that I care about in my wardrobe. And as long as I choose well and the right quality and the right, you know, right for me in my own personal style and my lifestyle, I'm going to keep it and wear it for longer. And I'm seeing more and more of that. And I think that's what I started to observe in the customer. It's just much more mindful consumption and seeking out, in fact, something that's smaller, more luxurious and more unique. They don't want to be the same as everybody else, and they don't necessarily want to buy something that they feel is contributing to the kind of global issues of climate. They'd rather have something that means something to them and feels much more special and lasts a long time. And I'm seeing that also with younger customers too, that, you know, it happens at my end in the sort of luxury sector. We're beginning to attract younger customers again. For me, that's the first little spark of hope that things are shifting and changing in that direction.
Oh, yes. That was, I think in terms of being an artist, I think, yeah, I mean, I already exist in that sort of niche market anyway. So actually people who are only... who are these connoisseurs are other people who are going to come to me anyway. So I'm actually really happy that my work is not sort of widespread like that. That's not my aim at all. It is really about taking people on a bit of a journey with me. And sometimes that's not an immediate sale. That might take 5 years to sale. You know, so I, you know, that, and I think that is quite nice. It's again, it is about sort of taking time, getting to know a collector. I mean, and then really understanding the practice and the process before they really commit. It's a very long-term purchase with anything that I make. So I think there are there is that new customer. But I think in the art world, in the craft world, they already existed. But I think that is definitely filtering out into sort of more mainstream markets.
Sandra, did you have a response to this idea of connoisseurship and meta?
I mean, I think we've just got to keep campaigning and seeing that and keeping going. I've always thought the main thing for me is to just keep going.
That's the perfect way to end. So thank you to our amazing guests, Sandra Rhodes, Piers Atkinson, and Ray Bradshaw, and Richard Perkins.
Thank you so much for listening. I'd like to thank our sponsors, Intellect Books, and of course, our amazing guests, Dame Sandra Rhodes, Maria Grushvogel, Richard McVettis, and Piers Atkinson. Next time, we'll have another fantastic conversation recorded live from the In Pursuit of Luxury conference. Thank you again for listening. And if you enjoyed the episode, please subscribe to help us reach you easily with future episodes. Don't forget, you can catch up on all previous episodes of the In Pursuit of Luxury podcast on your favorite listening platform. See you next time.